The show is all about digging into what actually happened, right? The motive, the timeline, the details most people skip right past. If you're the type who can't stop breaking the story down, Zen AI is built for you. It's called vibecasting, and a vibecast is just a conversation, the kind you're already having every time a game's on. Right now, Zen AI is paying new vibecasters to record their first one, a sportscast about the team you love. Call the game live as it happens, or sit down after and break the whole thing down play by play. Bring your own co-host, or find another diehard in Zen AI's network to go back and forth with. Here's the part I like. Your phone is the studio. No gear, no booth, no setup. You just talk and their AI producer handles the edit, turning your conversation into something worth sharing. Humans are the talent, AI is the infrastructure. Vibes required, production optional. It doesn't have to be long, polished, or a whole series. One good conversation counts and you get paid for it. It's invite-only beta right now, so get on the waitlist before spots fill. Go to zen.ai, that's zen.ai, or grab the direct link in our show notes.
We are in agony. We cannot be in peace. Those are the heartbreaking words of Savannah Guthrie speaking out once again on the Today Show about the disappearance of her mother, Nancy Guthrie. It has to be the highest profile missing persons case ever, I would argue, in the United States of America. Now, 143 days since Nancy Guthrie went missing from her very own home in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. This is the global phenomenon, bringing you the very best guests in all of true crime. And the news pouring in 143 days later about the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie. There are more significant developments today, and you're in for a treat with another amazing panel of best guests in true crime. It is not a tagline. It is our reality. You have to go back to January 31st and February 1st of this past year, 143 days ago, when 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie, who was ill and had some health issues for sure, she vanishes from her home, apparently in the early morning hours of February 1st. Of course, her daughter, Savannah, one of the highest profile news anchors in all of America, hosting the Today Show. And you see the two of them there on the set of the Today Show, at least outside. Investigators at the time say that they found blood belonging to Nancy, evidence of a violent abduction, and surveillance footage showing a masked individual near the residence. We've all seen that Nest Cam video. Days later come a series of ransom communications. The first note demands $4 million in Bitcoin and claims Nancy was quote unquote safe, but scared. And then a second note. And according to the author of this investigative piece, Howard Bloom, who you're about to hear from, essentially the writer of that note says, "We're sorry." Implying that Nancy Guthrie died, and that is why Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show once again was speaking. We're going to get to all that, but this first. Of all the things that stress me out, and trust me, there is a very long list outside of health, money has got to be number one. I mean, Carm always says to me, "Joel, if it's a money problem, it is not a real problem," but I call BS. Without money, what can you buy? And I'll tell you what, things are getting worse, not better. You've got nagging inflation and the cost of living through the roof. So buying eggs, putting bread on the table is next to impossible. And that is why I'm so glad I found American Financing. They have salary-based mortgage consultants who understand that in 2026, you've got to have a better strategy than just piling up debt on your credit cards. American Financing consultants can help you save an average of $800 a month. They understand that you can use the equity in the home that you work so very hard to get. And listen, there are no upfront fees, no pressure. And if you start today, you could delay two mortgage payments. So call American Financing today, 866-890-9489. That's 866-890-9489. Or go to AmericanFinancing.net. /surviving. And here he is. He happens to be the man of the hour as far as journalism goes, Howard Bloom. He is an investigative journalist, has been one for many years. He wrote a book on the Idaho Four. Howard, you have a book coming out about, of all things, space. When does that book come out? Do you have a title? What's it about? What's going on?
The book is called Stranded, and it tells the story of the two astronauts who went on a mission to the International Space Station for just 8 days in a Boeing Starliner capsule. The capsule was faulty. They almost lost their lives on the trip up. They get stuck there for close to 9 months, and SpaceX has to come to the rescue and rescue them. Ron Howard is making the movie, and the book should be out next spring.
Wow. Congratulations. Sounds interesting. We will check it out. Howard, it's my issue having a little audio glitch. I'm going to mute Howard when I'm speaking. And next up to the table here, we've got Jen Coffendoff, for a friend of mine, friend of the show, a very experienced FBI retired special agent and host of Break the Case with Jen Coffendoff. Jen, welcome. What are your thoughts? We're, again, 143 days in right now, and this is all over the news. Are you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised. Anytime there's something breaking on this case, the world is really just looking for answers. It's unusual to have a case like this where you actually have a photograph and a video of the perpetrator and still nothing after 4.5 months. And I think that has a lot of people, including myself, very vested in this case and justice for Nancy Guthrie and her family.
Yeah, it's been way too long. Howard Bloom, let me unmute you here and bring up the first comment of many, I'm sure, tonight. And this person, Crown Royal, not to be confused with the bottle of alcohol. I don't believe those notes are real. But Howard, you are reporting that at least the first two notes are real. And before we get cracking here, let me. He was having a technical issue. Jason Pack, retired FBI special agent. He left the agency when he retired out of Knoxville. Welcome to Jason. And Jason has an interesting theory about the fingerprint with the ransom note. But Howard Bloom, how do we know that this first and second ransom note are, in fact, real?
Well, first off, I have not seen the ransom note. I have been in discussions with people who are familiar with them. And there's a task force of FBI agents and Tucson homicide detectives that have been working the case, largely be in charge of things, and they are now going over the ransom notes again. That's how I first got involved with them. You know, at this point, it's a desperation strategy. They're looking for anything because they really don't have anything. And they've divided the notes into what they call three types: the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the good notes were the ones that were originally received that have an IP address that seemed to make sense, that also provided information that they believed showed that they had Nancy Guthrie and that Nancy Guthrie was perhaps alive. The information was that there was a damage to the porch light and a back door light and a back door and what Nancy was wearing that evening. And the FBI and the Tucson police believe that this was real. And this was the one that Ed asked for $4 million. Then came the bad note, which was a sense, as it was described to me, an apology. The writer showed a sense of contrition, if you will, for what had happened, and then he turned tough. He was willing to make a deal. He would provide the whereabouts of Nancy Guthrie's body in exchange for money. He didn't specify a sum at that time. And then came the really ugly notes, which were just con men trying to take advantage of a horrible situation.
Okay. And one of them, by the way, had a court hearing that was scheduled for today. It sounds like there's going to be a plea deal in that case. And that's someone that was just trying to profit off of it. We're going to get to Jason and Jennifer in a minute. And I know that they're going to have questions for Howard. And there's also some other news that TMZ is reporting, and they've been all over the story. But Howard, I got to push back a little bit. So here you are. You've got a story that literally the world is talking about. It aired. It was published in Air Mail, which I believe is Graydon Carter, formerly of Vanity Fair, his digital publication. And it's regarding the ransom notes. But here you said you never have actually seen the ransom notes. I mean, does that give you pause for concern yourself as a esteemed investigative journalist that you haven't had your claws attached to those emails or notes?
No, I haven't had my claws, such as they are. They're little writerly little hands, but dainty even. But be that as it may, you know, this was also that my reporting was confirmed today by several sources, by ABC News, by CNN, and I think Savannah's, you know, heartfelt emotional plea today on the Today Show sort of demonstrates that I was right. So, but again, I've never claimed in the article that I actually saw the notes. I reported live and die by sources.
And NBC did confirm parts of what Howard is reporting, specifically the fact that they believe that Nancy, I think, died. But Howard, this is fascinating to me as a one-time investigative reporter with Fox 5 in New York City. I mean, this is not a story that, as far as I know, that you were that vested in. So just without giving away sources and obviously specific information, and there are people, you know, who may not be in the world of journalism. So Howard is not going to sit here on this show and say, you know, Joe Smith gave me this information because he's a journalist, and he's not going to do that. But obviously Howard got the information. But just explain again how you got kind of pulled into this.
I mean, you were entirely right. I was invested, to be quite candid, nothing to hide. I had spent the past 8 months virtually locked in this room writing that space book day and night. I finished it I handed in the draft April 28th. And in the aftermath, I was approached by airmail, how would you like to dig into the Nancy Guthrie case? And I was so glad to get out of this room. I said, sure, I'll be glad to go to Arizona. I got on a plane and I spent a couple of days, and then it stretched on and on for actually more days, poking around and meeting people. And I have, over the years, developed sources in law enforcement and also federal investigators who also had people, and I was able to stumble upon some things.
And I promise I'm getting to Jason and Jennifer, but Howard, what surprised you most on your trip to Tucson, other than the javelina, I mean, pertaining specifically to the Nancy Guthrie case? What would you say was I don't know, your biggest aha moment there?
To me, before I actually got to Tucson, there are a couple of things. I thought, you know, she was living in the wilderness. Well, it's, you know, the 5-minute drive up to a major roadway filled with Dunkin' Donuts, Starbucks, hospitals, medical centers. It's like any suburban street. She's really living in suburbia. It's not an isolated place for an old woman to be living. That was the first. The second thing was the sheer antagonism between the police and the federal agents. I wasn't prepared for that. And the third thing is something I'm exploring now. Did they have a chance to actually save Nancy Guthrie? If the original $4 million had been paid, if people involved in the investigation had not been too smart by half and trying to demand proof of life, or whatever. The money could have been paid into a crypto wallet. The FBI, I believe, is sophisticated enough to have followed the money, to have gotten the money back. Why not take that risk? The money was there. You would have saved this woman's life, perhaps. Maybe not, but at least you would have tried. And I think that was a major mistake at the beginning of the investigation. And some people really have to live with that decision and the horror that's a result of it.
And Howard, I gotta, so this antagonism, because we've reported on it, we have people from the Pima County Sheriff's Department who are retired who have not great things to say about Sheriff Chris Nanos. Was there more pushback going from Pima County to the FBI, or the FBI to Pima County? Which way was the tension thicker, I guess?
To the people I talked with, they were sort of shocked on both sides. I mean, Cash Patel came in there with his elbows sharp and pushing around, and he took a bad situation and made it worse. He exacerbated things. And the Guthrie family was caught in the middle of these warring factions. In many cases, you know, as you said, I covered the Koberger case. There was tensions and all this, but they didn't go publicly at each other's throats. And, you know, it must have been, it is a horrible, horrible spectacle for the Guthrie family to watch and see it unfold. And they're being helpless while the people they're counting on are fighting with each other. And I wonder right now if the Guthrie family has made other plans. I'm hearing things to try to get to the bottom of things independently.
I would assume that is hiring their own investigators. One final question here. Howard, were there more than two kidnappers? Did your reporting reveal anything about the number? And then I'm getting the coffin duffer.
Well, again, you know, my reporting reveals that what do the people on the task force think about now? They are convinced that there were two kidnappers at least. These videos that we've seen, those spectral images of the guy in the ski mask at the camera in front of the house. Well, he seems like a bit of a bumbler. You're taking up weeds and stuffing them in the camera. His holster strapped on his waist like he's a bandito. And yet the ransom notes, as they were explained to me, again, I haven't seen them, were articulate, intelligent, and certainly showed a knowledge of cryptocurrency. So the people I've spoke with have spoken about the brains and the brawn of this kidnapping case. There was a brawn who took the body out, and as a result, there was blood scattered around the path to the house, and then there was a brains who wrote the notes.
And we're going to get into that for sure. Welcoming into the show, and I don't usually do this, but Howard Bloom has a story that everyone is talking about. In Air Mail is the name of the digital publication. It's Graydon Carter, who is formerly of Vanity Fair and a legend in the media business. Gia, DJ's mom, gifting 5 memberships. And look at this, Immortal Sergeant is back. I love that name. If I could click him up here. My computer is running a bit slow today. Hello to Immortal Sergeant. So Jen Coffendoffer, this isn't the only news. And by the way, and we'll get Howard's reaction to this, but Harvey Levin said Howard's reporting. No, mine is more accurate than Howard's. And he's been going out on TMZ in a bit of a verbal jousting, I think more one way from Harvey to Howard than the other way around. But TMZ late this afternoon, Jennifer, reported that a source that they describe as connected to the FBI, so a source connected to the FBI, reached out regarding the ransom note investigation and suggested investigators are looking closely at the possibility that the communications may not have been written by the person or people initially imagined. One possibility being examined is that the author could be a woman. We've seen the masked guy on the porch. Now TMZ is saying maybe it's a woman. Wow, this is going from, you know, a whodunit to what is going on here, Jennifer. Your reaction to TMZ's reporting there. And I don't typically, look, people make fun of TMZ. People are constantly ripping on TMZ. They break a lot of news. So when they say something, you kind of have to take it somewhat seriously. But go ahead, Jen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So when you look at that, I think it's a lot surrounding sort of the language that is they are saying, and everybody is saying, these sources are saying was used. For instance, buried in nature. That's my understanding that those are the words that were used. I would love to hear if Mr. Bloom concurs with that verbiage, because I think you did. And that's very interesting if that verbiage is used. It almost makes me wonder, too, could this person have their first language be Spanish or Romantic language, and AI was used to make this actual ransom notes that we're talking about, the first two that I too believe are legitimate. It makes me look at a lot of different options, and I think it's that softness, that language. Who ever heard of somebody who does a kidnapping, giving them a play-by-play that the person's dead and, oh, it was an accident? It's really kind of unheard of, Joel.
Yeah. Howard, let's let you dive in there. I mean, what, if anything, did you learn about the verbiage of the notes? Have you heard that it's potentially a woman? And we'll get back to the I like that they're breaking it up into the good, the bad, and the ugly with Clint Eastwood.
Well, go ahead. I mean, I think I can say with a great deal of authority that it either is a woman or a man. I mean, you know, this is sort of absurd. Yeah, TMZ can say it might be a woman. Well, yeah, they have a 50% chance they'll be right.
So, well, let me rephrase it. Has your reporting shown it to be a woman? Has anything pointed to that?
I really don't know. At this point, what this does show is the desperation of this case. They're just looking, they, not TMZ, the investigators, are trying any kind of theory. And I think ultimately all these theories are going to get them nowhere. The only thing that's going to help is money. Someone's going to decide that they want the $1 million or $1.2 million it is reward, and they're going to rat on what they know. And that's the only way this case will be solved, I think.
Jason Pack, welcome. First time best guest. Very happy to have him. As you can see, he pulled over for us, which I love. Hopefully the audio remains strong. Jason actually was quoted in a New York Post article. He has a whole theory about the fingerprint. We're going to get there. But what about this notion now that TMZ is floating it out there that this masked man on the porch, number one, is definitely not working alone. Number two, could be working potentially with a female perpetrator here. Your reaction?
Well, I think we're all using our sources and playing a bit of a game of telephone here, although some of us are better at it than others, I think. But, you know, we're talking to people and seeing what they think about it, and then we're kind of turning that into what we know based on our experiences. And so I think maybe that's what we're hearing a little bit of here. Having said that, having been in a lot of these command posts, particularly for missing kids, which is my expertise in the Bureau, it would take somebody pretty strong to move someone and do all these things that you would have to do when somebody dies on you unexpectedly. That I just think that there's, I agree with the panelists here. It's probably going to be more than one person. And if somebody is writing the letter that sounds different, there's a way to do that. I mean, if you're clever, you can set up for artificial intelligence to make you sound different. If you're trying to, it's kind of like digitally masking your ID. Again, we all have our theories here. I don't know if that's what happened. Certainly with the technology today, it's a possibility. And getting to that, the fingerprint thing, and I think our panelists also agree, these first two notes that came out, I think because of the information that was known to only law enforcement and the FBI, I think those got a lot more credibility than the rest of the scammers did. And so at first, it seemed like, hey, should we pay the ransom? Should we pay the ransom? They had that little bit of a mouse trap, I would call it, in there. It didn't really spring, and sometimes that does happen. But when you're working with families as a crisis negotiator, it's always up to them whether to pay or not. They had the benefit, hopefully, of everything that the Pima County Sheriff's Office and the FBI knew. Hopefully they were giving them that information and they were making informed decisions, because they would have all the information, and us on the outside here probably don't have as much as we should to make those decisions.
Yeah, and I just want to say, by the way, big thanks to, you heard Jason say his expertise is missing children. So while we're all reporting on it, it was Jason and Jennifer who were in the middle of the actual battle. So thank you for your service to both Jason and Jennifer. We've got a news package here from NBC News from this morning, and then that now, I guess, yet another infamous reaction here from Savannah Guthrie regarding her mother. Let's watch this together.
This note had already been known and reported on, but now for the first time, we're learning and sharing the contents of that letter, which prompted an emotional message at the time from Savannah and her family to her mom's alleged kidnapper.
This morning, new details coming out regarding the ongoing investigation into Nancy Guthrie's disappearance. According to three people familiar with the matter, the second of two notes sent to media outlets from an alleged kidnapper following the 84-year-old's disappearance indicated that Nancy had died. The note made no further request for money. Shortly after it was sent, Savannah and her siblings sharing this video, speaking directly to whoever took their beloved mom.
We received your message and we understand. We beg you now to return our mother to us so that we can celebrate with her. This is the only way we will have peace. This is very valuable to us, and we will pay.
That second note coming days after media outlets received an initial alleged ransom note indicating that Nancy was safe and demanding $6 million in Bitcoin in exchange for her release. NBC News has previously reported on both notes, but the contents of that second note have not been made public until now. Investigators involved in the case believe the notes are potentially credible, a sentiment shared by Savannah during her interview with Hoda.
I believe the two notes that we received, that we responded to, mm-hmm. I tend to believe those are real.
Who's behind those notes is still unknown, as is the identity of that masked armed man captured on Nancy's doorbell camera in the early morning hours when she was taken. Savannah recently opening up to Jenna about the agony she feels every day.
I cry every morning on the way to work, and I cry every morning on the way home. And I'm grateful to have good friends and to be able to come to such a beautiful and joyous and supportive place. And like so many people out there, you know, you can hold all of these things together. I try to tell my kids that too, you know? We can hold our sadness and we can hold our joy. And just, if you don't believe it, just watch me. I'm gonna show you.
And despite these new details, unfortunately, Craig, there is still no major update or break in the case. Investigators are still searching for that masked man and trying to find a match with some of the DNA that they uncovered at the home. Craig.
All right, Liz Quartzforce there in California. Liz, thank you. The bravery and courage with which you have done this job every day since that happened, nothing short of remarkable.
Wow.
Nothing short of remarkable.
I love you guys and I love this place, and this is unusual and unprecedented to say the least to be sitting here. But, you know, I don't have any comment on the story, and I'm not involved in our coverage, but I can't pretend I'm not here. And so since I am, I wanted to just take the opportunity to ask people to really to beg people to come forward. Somebody knows something. And this is a new story today that is on your radar, but this is the life that my sister lives, that I live, that my brother lives, that our extended families live, that our children live every day. And we are in agony. And we cannot be at peace. So no matter how much I try to come out here every day and smile and find that joy, and I will, I promise I will. This is a moment to tell you that we need your help. We're begging for your help. And I'm not going to miss that opportunity. And so please, if you're watching,
yes.
No matter how small, the reward is there. You can tell us. It can be anonymous. Please do the right thing for us, for our family, for our children. And we love our mom and we'll never stop looking for her. Never.
To your point, if you have any information, if you're watching, if you're listening, if you have any information at all that could help investigators and could help this family find just a modicum of peace, the phone number is right there on your screen. 1-800-CALL-FBI.
1-800-CALL-FBI. Eyes on Heaven pointing out that they are actually literally in funeral colors today, all wearing black and dark, deep grays. Jennifer Coffendoffer, this is difficult to watch. Just your reaction to Savannah's reaction to that news story. I mean, it's both difficult and a bit awkward because they're reporting on her mother, and we all know she's fighting through this in real time, yet they're asking her questions.
Yeah, you know, it was a very visceral reaction. I truly believe she's telling the truth, and this is just heart-wrenching for her. And every day that there is new news, she has to relive it. And I think this family is just suffering with the unknown and the loss.
Mm. I see here from Ice, heartbreaking for the family. Howard Bloom, back to you, and let me make sure I can unmute you here. What did your reporting, if anything, suss out about my computer's on a real delay, I apologize. What did your reporting discover anything about the Guthrie family? You mentioned that they might try to take things into their quote-unquote, I guess, own hands. They've got to be incredibly frustrated. Savannah's putting on a brave face, but what have you found out about how difficult it is for this family on a day-to-day basis?
Well, you don't have to be an investigative reporter to find out how difficult this is for this family. I mean, this is horror. What is interesting to me as a journalist is that she's the victim, and Savannah, and also a reporter reporting it too, and she's handling both of those jobs and responsibilities with a great deal of grace and intelligence. And NBC had to make a decision how are we going to deal with this? We have one of our reporters who is the story, and how are we going to cover her and use her without seeming like we're exploiting her? And all this is a very delicate balance, and I've been watching to see how it unfolds. You know, reporters go out and cover stories like the Idaho murders, and you're accused right away. You're a grifter. You're covering tragedy. You're exploiting it. Well, here, the reporter who is the object of the tragedy is also covering it too, and allowing her bosses to use her to cover it. And I find that fascinating, that almost the meta-journalistic aspect of it.
And Jason Pack, I know this is not really your world, like the PR aspect, but what do you think of NBC's, I guess, handling of this situation? It is, as I said, it's unprecedented. I don't know if anyone can name a bigger missing persons case. I think, you know, people have said Elizabeth Smart. You've got Howard will remember this well, Eitan Peets, not calling Howard out about his age, but he's, you know, he remember. Hold on, Howard. Yeah. Go ahead, Howard.
I thought you were going to say the Lindbergh baby. We're talking about my age, but no.
So Eitan Peets was a huge, I talked about it yesterday, first kid on a milk carton, and they just, the Supreme Court overturned that. But Jason, to you, what do you, I mean, this is a very strange position for NBC to be in, and I know some people are just uncomfortable watching Savannah at this point on her own network because of what happened to her. What do you think?
Well, first of all, just to watch her go through that and be re-victimized every time she has to talk about it, it just goes to show you how her strong her she is, her faith, and how much that her family there at NBC and her faith family have come together to kind of support her. I think people want to see people who are just real. So many times we see news anchors and we see reporters, you know, they're everywhere. They seem kind of not real to us. And to be able to see people in their own humanity, I think is really effective out there. And I think just for her to be able to say, hey, yeah, that was a story about my mom, but I'm not going to miss this opportunity. I'm not going to let the bad guys win. Every time I can talk about it, I'm going to say, we need your help. Public, call in the tips. And you know, this it's very unusual for somebody to be living this out so publicly. What Jennifer and I have seen as FBI agents, there are all these families in the United States who are going through something very similar that every day that they get up, they go to work, and they wait on that phone to ring. Is today going to be the day that there's a break in the case? And so having, you know, having to watch that is very just so sad for the family and very heartbreaking. So hopefully, you know, hopefully, like Howard said, and Jennifer thinks too, this money and this reward, along with some investigative work by the agents in the Pima County Sheriff's Office, will bring a break in the case soon.
Hmm. Jen, you know, a lot of people have just, I mean, across the board have speculated, some people saying it's an inside job, others say, you know, which Sheriff Chris Nanos has, you know, unequivocally said the family has nothing to do with this. But if you're the FBI and you were the FBI, it seems like, and according to Howard's reporting, all the focus now is back on these ransom letters. Are they literally, I mean, do they have them stacked up? We don't even know exactly how many they have because the FBI was not going to sit here and tell us. But what are they doing with these ransom notes right now? Are they trying to figure out how many there actually are? How many of those are real? How many could come from different people? And this is a Jason Pack question as well. But Jennifer, you go first.
Well, one thing that Howard said that I had never heard yet is that there is an IP address associated with those communications. This is the first time I've heard that. And that is huge, because if there is an IP address, which again, we've never heard about, that's my biggest takeaway from tonight in terms of something I did not know. That's huge, because now at least you have more information to go on and delve into. Now, obviously, this could be a Proton address. It could be an IP address associated with a public email, public Wi-Fi, I should say. So there's all of these factors that go into it. But Howard, my jaw about dropped when you said that.
Yeah. Howard, I'll let you dive in here real quick. Thank you to Judy Herbert. Perhaps the most generous in all of SDS Nation, hoping the family gets some closure here. Howard, can you confirm this? Have they focused in on a singular IP address for multiple notes?
One of the reasons that was, as it was explained to me, why the first two notes were taken seriously and they were thought they were sent by the same sender is because of the IP address. So the similarities, if not the sameness of the two IP addresses, caught their attention, convinced them this was real. The note, the first note, which talked about the broken outside light fixture and what Nancy was wearing, was the same IP address, very much with the second note. That's why they think the two are the same.
And does it end there? Because I think people are having trouble trying to figure out when you're reporting, did you find exactly how many notes were sent? Because from what I understand, there's also one communication, and maybe I misunderstood this, but between the first two ransom notes, but how many ransom notes have you confirmed to be authentic? What's the timeline on those?
What I found is that there's a great deal of confusion about what they're saying. Originally, I was told there were two notes that were authentic, the one that asked for the $4 million and then the one that was the apology. Later, I was told there was one in between that also might have been authentic. And so I think now, and I again, you know, people are telling you information. They're talking quickly. They don't want it. Everyone is, you know, cute. They don't want to be directly quoted. They're giving you inferences. But I think now there were more than two, perhaps three good notes that came from, they thought, people who were involved, actually involved in the kidnapping.
All right, two or three. So this is Jason Pack's world here. And Jason, from Julian Bauman, isn't there an IP address with every email? For those of us like me who's not technologically savvy, just start with the most basic. I mean, what is an IP address and what does it tell you?
The IP address identifies the server from which the email came, but it hops around a lot. And so in an email, there's something called headers. And so agents will want to take a look, and investigators to take a look at that header, and it delineates every step that email took to get into your inbox. So a lot of times people will hide their IP addresses. They'll use anonymizers. People who are pretty savvy know how to hide their identity. And so while the IP address is an important clue, and it's definitely a lead to cover, what also behavioral analysis, the units are doing something called statement analysis. And that's where they're looking at these notes side by side. They're comparing the similarities, the language, any cultural differences or similarities against the rest of those notes. And so that way you can say, hopefully with some statistical probability, is this the right person? Is this the same person that sent the first two or three, or are these other ones different? And so looking at all those, the way they were written, what's left out, like is there more detail in one area or another? There's a certain tactics that the FBI has, and not just the FBI, but investigators who've been trained in statement analysis to kind of look and see what's in these ransom notes, and more importantly, what's not in there. What did they leave out? And as Jennifer talked about, the wording, is this their first language? So like, there are a lot of things to look at, and that's why we call this like the fingerprint, because each the way people write in different patterns. They have different ways of expressing themselves. And so getting a norm for that, it's hard to do in a couple of letters, but you can kind of take these statements, put them up side by side, and see how they are similar or different to the rest of the notes or any other communication that the kidnappers may have had with the family or police.
Yeah, and Jason uses the phrase fingerprint metaphorically. But Jason, back to you on this from Locked and Loaded. Dudes don't talk about returning to nature, in my opinion, says Locked and Loaded. Obviously, there is AI today. That is a new thing to contend with. I mean, does the FBI, as far as you know, and I'm sure you left before this was really a thing, but do they have tools to figure out if Jen said this earlier, and I'll have to go back to her, maybe this is a foreign speaking person and they used AI? Because returning to nature sounds very sort of AI-ish to me. Is that part of the statement analysis or the decoding of the fingerprint?
That's definitely a new aspect to consider, whether it was written. And sometimes we all have seen terrible AI things posted and copied and pasted, words we usually don't use, like at the intersection of, or underscores, or fun words like that AI just kind of spits out that really, well, at least nobody here in Tennessee uses. Maybe you guys use them and you're more refined, but we don't use them here too much anyway. So having said that, yeah, that's something you do. But I think usually when I was trying to translate something on a translating app, that would be where it would turn into the literal translation and not the cultural translation or meaning. And so that's why it's sometimes difficult or dangerous to use this actual translation app and just go with that, because the words might mean literally things in English, but they may not have the same meaning. And so maybe that's what we're talking about. Also, what does nature mean? You're there in the Arizona desert, but you're just a few miles from the mountain. You could even make it to the ocean. So it's a vast array of there. And when people, the BAU, the Behavioral Analysis Unit, put out a research a few years ago about body dumping and serial killers. No, we're not.
Oh.
Oh, Jason has fallen off. We'll get him back. Jen, let me switch over to you about statement analysis here. So when it comes to the emails specifically, I did some research on it. They're looking, the FBI that is, at word choice, sentence structure, grammar, punctuation, tone changes, escalation patterns, how the writer talks about Nancy. I mean, this seems like pretty painstaking type of stuff, but I obviously assume that the FBI has experts who are, this is their world. They look at this. How much can we depend on these experts to figure out what part of these ransom notes, which ones are real and which ones are not?
Well, as Jason mentioned, this is an actual comparison. So that's the good news. It's not like you're actually looking at trying to figure out, as an example, from all the writing, who this might be, right? You're really just trying to compare to the other ransom notes and say, do these have a match to these? If not, but they match each other, you can at least consider them a similar source. But how they've been described as being so encyclopedia-like, so intelligent, the wording structure really draws me to this possibility. And I just wanted to say the FBI definitely has the tools, and then they also have subject matter experts they can go to confirm or not confirm that this would be an AI type transmission.
And that's really good to know. Howard Bloom, to you first. Jason, you dropped off there, so I just wanted you to get a chance to finish off your thought. You were in the middle,
I was just going to talk about the behavioral analysis, the profilers research, and the serial killers, where they say that, people go back, particularly people who are panicked when things happen, things don't go as planned, which this looks like what happened. They made the kidnap for ransom. It apparently turned into a death, accidentally or not. She died on them. They had to do something. So usually the statistics show within a 15-mile radius is where people go to get rid of something, like a body or something, if they were panicked like that. So hopefully, I don't know if they've searched 15 miles away or not, but that's using statistics to give you a starting point. It's not a guarantee, but the research goes along with that, particularly in cases like this where, people may not have intended to harm someone, but when it happens, they have to act quickly. And so that's where I think they probably should start if they're going to start looking anymore.
Howard, jump in.
Yeah, I'd like to ask, Jason and Jennifer, they're the authorities. So they've been in the front lines. I'm just a reporter, knocking on doors.
Howard, I'm bringing your sources to the front door here.
No, but if you got someone, they're asking $4 million for someone's mother, and they're asking it from rich people, would you have told them, go ahead, pay the money? This is all we've got now. Let's not be too smart by half. Let's get this done. Would you guys advise that? What's the FBI's policy on that?
Jason, you first.
Yeah. As a negotiator, we've been in many living rooms like this. There, without giving away all of our tactics and our trade craft a little bit, each case is unique, and it's up to the family to decide whether or not to do that. That's the bottom line in all this. However, if they choose to do it, then the FBI can help them facilitate how to do it, the best way to do it. Not everybody, I don't know if you've ever tried to send $4 million. It's not easy to do any amount of money that's large. So it's a hard thing to do, so helping them with logistics and all that. I would never second guess a family put in that position. It seems like that maybe Ms. Guthrie didn't make it as long, even long enough to give them a proof of life. Generally, without a proof of life, you know, people who are skilled at kidnapping know you're going to want a proof of life. So if these people are as sophisticated as they say they are and people believe them to be, they're going to want to, they're going to know that, hey, they're going to ask for a proof of life. So I don't know if they made it to that point and it didn't happen, but they should have been ready for that if they're if they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, Jen, $1.2 million, most professionals like you believed, I think, that with that sum of money, someone, and we did see, you know, some wackos coming out of the woodwork. But to Howard's point, I mean, how would you, back in your days as an FBI agent, how would you advise the family? I mean, generally, the government will never, you know, settle with a kidnapper and pay ransom. But what do you tell a family?
Well, first of all, there are different rules depending on what side of the border you're on. I'll tell you that much, because when you're south of the border, these negotiations go on all the time. Jason can confirm that with us here. This is something that when you're across the border, you have cartel groups that this is just part of their business. The ransoms they ask often are well within the means to be paid and to be paid quickly. And the quid pro quo actually works. Where you pay it and you get the person back. On this side of the border, it's a little bit different because, as Jason was mentioning, the entirety of the case dynamic and everything going on, all the facts, all of that needs to be presented to the particular family. I would have even presented cases that are similar, crypto cases, wrench by proxy cases. I would have shown them examples where individuals were returned and those types of facts so that they could compare them to this case, because they need to make an informed decision at the end of the day. But at the end of the day, it was solely the Guthrie's decision to decide.
Howard Bloom, we're looking at a photo here. You've got Savannah and Nancy on one side and then the Google Nest man on the right. If you had to put it at a percentage, 70%, 80%, 90%, what is the percent chance that this is not the person who wrote the first two ransom notes?
Well, I would say it's a 70%. He wasn't the one who wrote the ransom notes. Not so much from this photograph. I just remember the picture where he's picking up weeds and shoving them into the Nest cam. And that seemed totally ridiculous. And this outfit with the holster, to me, that doesn't strike a much verisimilitude of a real mastermind.
And Howard, another important thing, apparently in the first note, it's a $4 million demand. And then there are things that are mentioned at the time in that note, like the Apple Watch and the broken floodlight that was not public information. What did your reporting find regarding those very specific details that would only be known to someone who knew something about the crime scene?
Well, you know, that was heart-wrenching, the way it was described to me, to the Guthrie family. These were the actual clothes she was wearing. They knew about the porch light. You know, you're finding someone who you believe has your mother. They're asking $4 million. They're giving you a timeline. Now, you can negotiate and ask for proof of life and try to go back and forth, or you can say, let's get this over with. My mother's 84 years old. Here's $4 million. I'll count on the FBI and their, you know, tech squad, their crypto squad, to get my money back, or at least part of it. But let me do what I can to get my mother. And that, I think, was a really rough decision for everyone involved. And I'm hearing for the first time from the two ex-FBI agents that it ultimately was the Guthrie's decision and not the Bureau's decision. And that's pretty interesting. That's a lot to live with.
It is a good way to look at it. McSpunky here gifting super chat. Thank you to McSpunky. This is now Brianna Whitney, who was a reporter in the Phoenix area and is working for, I want to say True Crime Junkie, forgive me. But this is her with some reporting today, additional reporting.
Some reports surfacing this afternoon about the second Nancy Guthrie ransom note. Some media confirming that it said Nancy died and that she was buried in nature. I'm Brianna Whitney, Crime Junkie's breaking news reporter, and I have spent months and months covering the Nancy Guthrie case, boots on the ground. And in my former role, before I came to Crime Junkie, I was made aware of what these ransom notes said as I was reporting on the case. I've seen them with my own eyes. So I want to actually provide more context as to what that second note said. The way that this note was written, it's written as we, like we didn't know this, as if it was some sort of team or whoever was involved in this. It said, we did not fully grasp the seriousness of her physical condition. It went on to say that they never intended to hurt her during all of this. They continued and said she perished shortly after she was taken. They believe that it was heart related. And then what the reports were confirming earlier today, that she was buried with nature. And maybe the most important part of the second ransom note, it said, nothing you could have done could have changed the outcome. We are truly sorry. So that's what I know from my reporting on this case. And that second note came in the first week of the investigation. Now, the FBI never came out and confirmed whether or not these ransom notes are legit. We knew that they were investigating them. Months have gone by. They never confirmed more. But we do know that Savannah Guthrie said she believes that these two notes are real. We will keep you up to date on the Nancy Guthrie investigation as it continues.
There you go. Former Phoenix reporter, now reporting for Crime Junkie, is a big breaking news reporter. Howard Bloom, to you, written as we, the kidnappers, plural, did not grasp the physical condition, didn't realize the frailty of Nancy Guthrie. She perished shortly after, thereafter, buried with nature, which is a phrase that keeps coming up. Nothing you could have done would have changed it. So almost, you know, an empathetic shout out to the family. How does your reporting either coincide or diverge from this? Is it pretty precise?
Well, this is a lot more precise in my reporting. What I said is that the note contained an apology, as it was described to me, and they showed contrition. And this does show contrition. And that, again, you know, makes one think that these aren't professional kidnappers. This is not a cartel group. I can't imagine a cartel group showing contrition or apologizing. It seems like amateurs who saw an opportunity to make some money, who thought that they shouldn't have, and some people shouldn't have the success that they don't have. And they were envious and they tried to change things.
You see how popular Howard Bloom is. If he's anything like me, it could be his mother on the line. I don't know. Jen Coffendoffer, to you, this was, I guess, a little more detailed. Even Howard is admitting than his own reporting. Written as we, didn't grasp the physical condition. This last part is really, I don't know, pulls at your heartstrings that there's nothing you could have done. It's almost like, don't feel bad, Savannah and Annie and Cameron. There's nothing you could have done. She just died on us. Your takeaway from Brianna's reporting here.
Well, first of all, this is for me a huge epiphany reporting, as you know, Howard just said, and as we just heard with our own ears, wow, the detail. We wondered what was in that note. There is an apology, according to her. We mentioned that whole phraseology now has me totally changing my position on this case, because I agree with Howard. This is something that is almost personal, that they are somehow connected with Nancy in some way, against something that we've talked about for a long time. But with this note, that seems obvious that they have this contrition in this note. I tell you, it's a big game changer for me personally.
Very interesting. This is all happening live, everybody, on Surviving Survivor, the show, the global phenomenon with the best guests in true crime. Jason Pack, again, underscoring, written as we didn't grasp Nancy's physical condition. We didn't realize her frailty. She perished shortly after. She's buried with nature. There's nothing you, the family, could have done. Do you agree with Jen Coffendoffer that this changes the dynamics and the calculus, that this is a more personal note here?
Yeah, well, if it's true, I do. I'm paid to be skeptical, so I'd want to see the note myself and draw my own conclusions, as I'm sure we all would. But I have no reason to doubt that the reporter that we just played there, she saw what she saw. However, I mean, that's what a lot of people I've talked to thought all along. Like, this got out of control really quickly. She passed away, like, pretty early on in it, and It just wasn't part of their initial plan, and so they had to react to it. So I think that's kind of why we see such a helter-skelter kind of investigation with that here.
Yeah, you know, just speaking about skepticism, Jen Coffendoffer, and reporters have to be that way too. Look, Sheriff Chris Nanos has come out multiple times and said, don't even look at this family. They're cleared. They're not suspects. But now even Jennifer Coffendoffer, I'm not saying she's saying the family's involved, but she's saying this is personal. This seems more personal. Number one, why is Chris Nanos, eliminating anyone as a suspect until the case is solved? That's number one. And number two, because it seems so personal, do you have to now go back and take a hard look at this entire family and all the circles around her?
Okay. Number one, this was not done in a vacuum, I don't believe, with Chris Nanos. Listen, I'm one of his biggest critics in this deal. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, working in these task force settings, there is no way he is going to be able to present what he wrote in writing about clearing that family and saying anybody who is cruel, that's the word he used, they are cruel if they suspect them. The FBI, I'm not saying they had any role in picking a lot of that language out, but they supported that position. And this isn't the first time we've seen this in these huge high-profile cases. We saw it in Idaho. They had a list every week. This person's cleared. This person's cleared. They're the famous cleared list. And the reason they did it is because now in this day and age, you have people on social media and then that filtering into life that their lives are in jeopardy. They are being, you know, have not only their lives threatened, but as I said, in real life, people doing things to them in their real life. So they needed to protect these people who were being pointed at wrongly. And I think this is the exact same situation, analogous with what we saw in the Idaho 4. To your second question, I do not believe it's the family for multiple reasons. But one of the things I do think now, more clearly, is that it was somebody that at least at some point intersected. I mean, for somebody not to understand her frailty could not have known her well. I don't think that's the thing. I've just really looked at the idea of a wrench by proxy, meaning a more sophisticated group getting a hold of a mope, porch guy being mope, and he gets to dress up for a night and gets to possibly make a lot of money, like we've seen in these other proxy types attack, take her and then hold her for ransom, and it all went south. I'm just wondering now, because the tone of this is much more caring, if this, as Jason said, is real.
Yeah, Jen, back to you on this from Brian's ramblings. And this is something that I know you talked about because I follow you closely on Twitter. 72 hours before Nancy vanished, and this is true, teenage Scottsdale home burglars tried to steal $66 million in crypto. I don't remember the number, but I'll take the word for it here. Police say that happened on March 26th, posing as delivery drivers to get inside and then adding access to cryptocurrency. Now, as far as I know, officials in the Phoenix Scottsdale area came out, even the FBI, and said this has nothing to do with it. But Jen, are you still wondering if there's some tie in here?
Well, that was a definite wrench attack. Those were two individuals, never knew each other, traveled 600 plus miles. They were kids, 16 and 17 years old. They were given seed money to buy these uniforms to make the trip. They walk in, and this is an actual wrench attack where you take the rich individuals and beat them up until they give you the cryptocurrency password. That's how that went down. They screwed up because they are mopes, and somebody upstairs was upstairs. They didn't check upstairs. They called the police, and the police come, and they end up in a high-speed chase. That's the story there. It was $66 million, and it happened on January 31st, about an hour and a half north of Nancy. Now, that makes you wonder, and then I've tracked many others, the rise in this wrench attack, and not just wrench attacks, like that one was, but wrench attack by proxy.
Jen, explain for those who don't know what a wrench attack, just explain what that is.
Really quickly, it comes from a cartoon, actually. And individuals are trying to talk, these cartoon characters are trying to talk about how they're going to get to the money that's in a Bitcoin account, basically. And then they said, oh, well, we're going to have to set up all these computer systems to do that. And they said, forget that. Let's buy a $5 wrench and we'll just beat it out of them. So that's the whole idea. And again, there's been, I want to get the right numbers there in my head. $1.2 billion in ransom paid in wrench attacks in 2023, over $800 million paid in 2024. To date, in 2025, over $800 million. And so, and again, I'm talking by proxy. And nobody thinks that somebody was going to go in there and a wrench. There's no information that she would even have crypto. But the idea that Savannah Guthrie could have, being a $45 million net worth person, that could be a possibility. So that was the whole idea, Joel. But if these notes are truly connected, I just don't know what kind of mope that wrench by proxy, more sophisticated group could hire that would have this sort of empathy. So it's falling apart for me.
Thanks, Jen. Jason, to you, I mean, what do you make of this notion that Jen is finding it on some level to be more personal? And I don't want to imply that the family here is involved in any way, because the exact opposite is what has been said publicly. And it could be someone who's on an inner circle or someone who works at the at the residence or something along those lines. But are you skeptical of that when the sheriff says everyone is cleared before there's an arrest, Jason?
Oh, it definitely is a broad statement, but I you have to, like Jen said, based on the information he had at the time, I think you do have to come out and say at least that, because of all the social media craziness that's going on. But that doesn't mean things could change as you get facts and details in. You go back and take a look. You just go where the evidence leads you. And so far, it doesn't look like the evidence has led directly to the family. Now, the reason you start at the family is because of statistical probabilities, like we learned in our classes, in our training, like, those are the people that are going to know the most about that and have the most opportunity to do that. Stranger abductions are pretty rare in the United States and elsewhere. So somebody associated with the family, somebody with a legitimate reason to be in the neighborhood, those are the types of people that you really want to focus on first after the family is cleared. So in any investigation, not just this one, any investigation, you take a close look at the people who were last seen with the person who's missing, and then you work your way back. And whether people have taken polygraphs or their statements are verified through cell phone records, witness interviews, on that timeline in the command post, there should be a piece of information that proves every single point in that timeline. How do you know that this is true? Because I have cell phone records that say this, because I interviewed so-and-so at this restaurant who saw them there, because I got data from the car that says this, this is the timestamp, it's matched up. So all those pieces of evidence go on that timeline. And so they must have had enough of that evidence to be able to say that early on.
One more thing I want to play, and then we're going to obviously get some final thoughts very quickly. There is a big manhunt. You might not have heard about it, going on in Kansas City. This guy opened fire after a World Cup match just indiscriminately. And it is, the FBI says, the most important manhunt that they're dealing with right now in the nation. So we're trying to do a show tomorrow. Yours truly and his son were just invited to another World Cup game tomorrow. So if I do it, it's going to happen at noon tomorrow. And then Thursday, the great Steve Cohen is, as they say in the news business, efforting to get back some of the big profilers in this country, including Ann Burgess and Greg McCrary, in light of what's going on with these ransom notes, to give us their take on what's happening Thursday night. So those are the next 2 days. Please hit the like and subscribe button. If you're new, we do this show Monday through Thursday, just like this, 7 o'clock, with the best minds in true crime, the best guests. And then Fridays, typically reserved, they're a little off Fridays, and it's with my mom, the oldest active true crime podcaster in America. Before I play Howard Bloom's arch nemesis, Harvey Levin, Howard, to you, after they got this second correspondence here, Did they do anything according to your reporting? Did they take action? Did they execute search warrants? Did they look at things more closely, or were they sitting on their behinds after the second note came in, Howard?
Well, first, let me address Harvey Levinby, my nemesis. I wish him well. I more power to him. I mean, I hope he cracks the case. I'm just a reporter running around knocking on doors. I have no nemesis, just an ex-wife. What do I think they did when they got the second note? I think there was, just real grief. And when they overcame their grief, they thought, wow, maybe we blew it. Maybe we should have put the money and paid it when we had the chance. Maybe that would have saved something. Maybe it wouldn't have. But now that opportunity was lost. I think there was a real feeling of failure.
Mm. By the way, Howard Bloom would out push up Harvey Levin 7 days a week. Howard, I have you muted, so you can't even respond to that. I'll let you respond on the flip side. Here's the first bit of Harvey Levin from today. He's all worked up over some of Howard's reporting.
Out in the Nancy Guthrie case. We received, as you know, the first ransom note along with two Tucson stations, television stations. And in that note, the kidnappers made it clear that they wanted $4 million within days of the time she was captured. And if the Guthrie family didn't pay that money, it would go to $6 million. And a week after the kidnapping, basically, they said they would kill her if they didn't get the money. So there was a second ransom note now that we know about that one of the Tucson stations got. In that note, which was sent 5 days after the kidnapping, it said that Nancy Guthrie was dead. And that apparently said she was buried somewhere. Now, we know that the second note did not contain a ransom demand. And that's why it was so confusing that following weekend, when Savannah Guthrie said to the world that they wanted to bring their mother home to celebrate, and they would pay the money. And that money was never paid. And we know that because we have the Bitcoin address, and the Bitcoin address in the first ransom note was the same as the Bitcoin address in the second ransom note. And no money was ever paid other than a very small amount that the FBI put in to see if they could trace the Bitcoin address, which they could not do. So the question then becomes, why did the Guthrie family fail to pay the money? When you think about it, that second note saying that she died accidentally, that they didn't kill her, but she died accidentally, which is the way this is now being reported. They're essentially saying, look, we didn't do it. We weren't there to kill somebody, even though we threatened to, and she died on us, and we're sorry, essentially. I don't think they used the words we're sorry, but they said, look, we didn't do it. She died shortly after the kidnapping, and it kind of makes sense with all her health problems, the fact that she didn't have her medications, and it must have been beyond extremely traumatic. So if that's true, what Savannah Guthrie is faced with is, we got this second note and we believe it's the kidnappers, but now they're not asking for a ransom demand in return for telling us where the body is. So we're putting it out to them. Tell us how much you want. Tell us where the body is so we can bring her home, because the $6 million may not be on the table anymore. They may be so freaked out and scared that she died and that they're going to be charged with murder that they're just basically leaving it alone.
That goes on. And there's another clip that I want to get to, and I don't want to listen to too much Harvey. So, Howard, since he's your arch nemesis, you get the first crack. I mean, what do you make of that?
I listened to that, and I don't think there's anything in my reporting that differs at all. I think it was a rather loquacious summary of my reporting. I think it was everything I said, and I think he confirmed it. So I don't see what the problem is. Maybe he's not my arch nemesis, but maybe he's a source. I don't know.
And I agree with Howard. I feel, Jason, to you, like almost that Harvey, we invited him on the show, almost like he's upset that the limelight was yanked from him with the reporting from both Howard and Brianna here. He basically said that he's confused as to why they didn't pay, why Savannah didn't pay. It was confusing because he said the second letter, there was no demand for money, but then they're confused by why the Guthries didn't pay. Is Harvey just being verbose there to say very little, Jason?
I don't know. Like, this is all, this case is such an outlier. Like, who negotiates through TMZ? Like, it's all just a kind of an interesting thing to, in its own right. But the good part is, I think he did hold back a little bit of information that we're now learning this week. So, to his credit, I don't think he divulged everything that he knew in hopes that it would protect the investigation and ultimately Miss Nancy's life. Sorry to say, it doesn't look like that's the case. It sounded like she died pretty quickly. I'm never going to blame a family or a victim's family for not doing something or doing something. I would not want to be in that position ever to have to make that choice to ever do that. So they had the best intelligence they could have. They had advice from Pima County and the FBI based on what they've done in the past. So just being able to have that information, and like, what would you do? Nobody could say what they would do unless they're in that situation. It's such a hard thing to do. Would it make a difference? I don't think we'll ever know, but you want to do everything that you can. And so I know that's a decision that they're going to live with the rest of their life. And I think they probably made the best decision, because if these are people who are professionals, they're going to want to know, we're going to have to give these people a proof of life. And apparently Miss Nancy didn't make it that long to give a proof of life. Mm. And even the letter said, there's nothing you could have done. Now, you know, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime, right? So like, whether or not they meant to happen, it did happen. And just think about it. They're sitting on the biggest secret in the world right now. The pressure that they must feel to keep that a secret, who's going to be the one to crack first, if it's more than one person. There's a lot of group dynamics there that eventually the pressure might cause someone to break on that. So if you do see people around and they're acting differently and you think they may be involved and their behavior changes or just things that don't seem right with them and they were, you know, in that area, then that's something you might want to call the FBI or the Pima County Sheriff's Office. It's like, hey, this just doesn't seem right. It may be nothing. We used to run those leads down all the time. A lot of people were apparently at big box stores. Apparently fugitives all like to go to the big box stores in every little town across the country, because I've spent many a day getting video from these places. Turns out people are well-intended, but it's just not the case. And then my last point here is, the best weapon that law enforcement has is the cooperation and the understanding of American people. People like your audiences, people who read Howard's articles, people I think are all really well-intentioned in their own way and want to be able to find out what happened to this. Yes, there's some sort of, you know, it's mystifying to kind of do this because it's a whodunit and a true crime kind of a thing. But in the end, I think people really feel for Savannah and her family. And as an agent, and now Jennifer feels the same way, we see this is something we've seen with victims' families across every spectrum of crime in the United States. And when we're watching these podcasts right now, there are agents, there are officers out working and making that knock on the door like, hey, your family member's not coming home. So there's a lot of things going on that out there. But I just think my final thought on this is that cooperation with the American public and the public really are the things that work best to team up and solve major crimes like this.
Jason, thank you. We're not quite done yet, but we're at the finish line here. Jen Coffendoffer. Jen Coffendoffer. By the way, there's never been a murderer who has not either been to a Home Depot or Walmart prior to committing the crime. So whenever I'm at a Home Depot or Walmart, I always have my eyes peeled as would Jen Coffendoffer, I'm sure. But Jen, your reaction to Harvey just getting on there and letting everyone know that he had all the original, you know, firsthand reporting on here. But to Howard's point, it's not much different than what Howard was reporting.
Yeah, you know, look, TMZ has pretty much owned this case when it comes to the media because they had the ransom letters. So they have been the one at the forefront from the very beginning. They received the ransom note 12 hours after the local stations did. So right away on day three, really only about 2.5 days into it. So they have definitely been at the crux of a lot of the reporting. So I think he wants to get out there. But do you have the second half of that where he says that they were going to put up the money? The $4 million that TMZ was going to pay it. And they went to the FBI and said, do you have that? I don't want to.
I don't know if we have it. It's going to take too much time, but go explain that, Jen, because I know TMZ themselves were going to pay this ransom. Go ahead as though we do have it and just explain what you're talking about, Jen.
Right. So that to me was a huge epiphany, lots of epiphanies tonight. I'm into that word. That saying about they were going to put up the $4 million. They offered that a month ago, so 4 weeks ago. And what they wanted out of it was, it's $4 million, but we're going to see it through. We're going to do a big docuseries on it. Yeah. We put money in, right? And I was thinking, well, they're going to do that anyway. they're going to try to do that anyway, but they wanted, I think he wanted Wright to be the hero to pay the $4 million and to figure out who the bad guys are. I thought from the beginning, I've said, why doesn't somebody pay that money? I call it tickling the wire. Joel, you and I have talked about this. Yeah. Get the money in there, see what happens, see if they can track that money. And to hear that TMZ was willing to foot the bill, I just thought that was very interesting, that what he said there.
I'm so glad you brought that up. He might very well say it on the back half, but imagine TMZ paying a $4 million ransom to see where that money goes. And that is, again, what they suggested to the FBI. And I think the FBI essentially said, get lost. From Holly Locks, and I have one more piece of sound, and then I promise final thoughts. I wish Howard Bloom would address this, but today on Nancy Grace, he said that the first note included a detailed description of the pajamas that Nancy was wearing that night. What do we know about this, Howard Bloom?
I think perhaps she misheard me, or at least I was talking indistinctly, perhaps. Maybe it was my fault, but I think it was what she was wearing. I think her clothes, it might have been my New York accent came out on Nancy Grace like pajamas. But what was sort of interesting about TMZ willing to put up the money because they get a great show out of it, and NBC is at the same time using Nancy Guthrie to get a show out of it too. So here are all these journalists using this story to get attention, to get viewers, and at the same time, they're also trying to find the kidnappers. It's a story within a story, and everyone's being altruistic, but at the same time, they're helping their networks.
Yeah, they've got a lot of interest. Here's a final thing about Harvey talking about the FBI contacting TMZ today.
That there is somebody who has been contacting us since Nancy Guthrie's kidnapping, saying they knew who the kidnappers were and where Nancy Guthrie was or where her body was, and that the FBI had been ghosting us because we had suggested maybe we could do a documentary where we pay the money, and there was something going
that they wanted,
and there was something going on where the FBI just did not respond to us. Literally 10 minutes ago, I was contacted by somebody in the FBI, and I am allowed to say this, that number one, what we said earlier in the show, that Savannah Guthrie didn't pay the ransom money from the first note because that second note didn't make a ransom demand, but just said she's dead,
right?
That it might have been that the kidnappers just freaked out that Nancy had died and they just didn't want anything to do with it.
Right. And then the video that Savannah made was because
she didn't know. She said, look, I will pay money. Tell us how to get our mom back. Right. And they didn't. And that was because they just freaked out.
So that video was just an outreach, hoping that someone would contact them with the information.
They said our take was their take as well,
right,
in terms of what had happened. That's number one. Number two, this person who had contacted us numerous times, nearly a dozen times, saying he knew the identity of the kidnappers and where Nancy was, we were told, well, I was just told two things. One, stand down on the notion of doing a documentary because they are not only looking for that person, but believe they can find that person. Mm. And they are actively engaged in that right now. And even though that person was using a male name, actually several male names,
yeah,
with the same the same Bitcoin address, that it could well be a woman. But they are on it, and that they are actively looking and believe they can find this person. I am allowed to say that.
We know they spent a lot of time looking over, how do I describe it, digital trace evidence of the communications we got.
Right.
We know that they pored over that.
Final thing that I was told was something I was told earlier. They were tripling down on this, saying that even if they don't find this person, they believe this case will be solved. Somebody's going to go to a bar in 6 months, a year, 2 years.
Yep.
Some a lover scorned is going to say something to police. They believe eventually this case is going to be solved.
And they say that from experience.
That's right.
It's happened in so many cases before. So
right.
Hard to believe that this is real life. You've got a tabloid journalist, Harvey Levin, who is talking on his own show about literally paying a ransom for arguably the highest profile missing persons case ever in the United States. So he can make a documentary about it. It's like P. Diddy. I was at that trial and he's got cameras rolling while his life isn't, you know, being decided in a courtroom. Jason Pack, we're sort of living in an idiocracy, just a weird world that we're in. You've got this tabloid journalism company, TMZ, now offering to pay the money for a documentary. And now he's saying that the FBI is telling them to stand down because they can find the person. How do you unscramble this? And your final thoughts now, sir?
Okay, I'm glad that we went on. I got several things to say about this. I spent a lot of my career as in the FBI's National Press Office and as a media rep in the field offices. FBI has 56 field offices. Everybody has a public affairs person as an investigator. So sometimes we would get members of the media to call up and voluntarily give us things. You know, there's certainly attorney general guidelines that definitely delineate freedom of the press and all these types of things. We want to have a fair, free press in the United States, whatever. But sometimes they become witnesses. And so in this case, it seems like TMZ would become a witness in this case. And hopefully he, you know, if I was coaching him, I would say, have the person you're talking to. If you don't want to have us there to talk to him, contact the FBI, contact us, like coach them at TMZ to have the person call us. And I don't know if the FBI can tell a member of the media to do something or not do something. I never was able to do that at all. You can explain why it might be important to not do that, particularly if they have leads. From what it sounded like, they have a few leads on who this person might be. So they're hoping to let the investigative process work out. I can't imagine a world. Well, I mean, we live in a crazy world now, but normally you would not tell a member of the media not to do something or not to run a story. That's just, that violates the Attorney General guidelines. That's not something that the FBI, when I was there, would ever do. Now, will we ask somebody to hold something? Maybe, just for those reasons I described. So all that to say, like, hopefully I would have tried to have him get this person on board Team America if he was going to do it or with us. So I don't know why that didn't happen. And as far as the $4 million, they're going to make the documentary like everybody said anyway. $4 million is probably not that much to finance a documentary that's going to get so many eyeballs and bring in so much revenue for them and get the clicks and get the, you know, get all the viewership and earn the money. So I think that's just would be part of the show. And it's like a live version of Cops that's going on for 5 months here, except we don't get to go into the command post and that kind of stuff.
Jason Pack, I ask all first-time best guests the following question. Will you come back? We loved having you.
Yep. I'm glad you didn't need the subtitles to understand me. Maybe you did. Maybe your audience as well. Small world. Somebody I grew up with is watching your watching the show here. So shout out to Beth. I grew up with them and here in Morristown, Tennessee, which is where I'm sitting today. So small world. It gets all the way around. So
do you know, Jason, do you know General Mark Davidson? He's a guest on our show. He's a DA for five rural counties somewhere near Knoxville.
What's his last name? Mark?
Mark Davidson.
Davidson. I've heard the name. I'm all around the state, so I'll have to look him up. Always hospitable here, so y'all come see us, all right?
Yeah, I would love for you to come back on. I will put this comment up to say there's no way. Daniel Radcliffe saying, I'll say it again, TMZ is tied into this. Very weird. Think about this hard. I'll bet you it'd be the biggest mistake of Harvey Levin's career. I don't think it's true, but Daniel will keep tabs on it. Jen Coffendoffer, we're living in a surreal world. This is When I was going through the ranks of media, and I was a nobody producer in the early mid 90s, all you wanted to do was be on the Today Show. It is still the largest morning television show. You've got the host of that show. The mother goes missing. This tabloid organization, TMZ, offering to put up $4 million in ransom. I mean, it's just so weird. You could, if I brought this to you as a screenplay, you'd say you're a dummy. This makes no sense. Where are we at? Not just in the world, but in this case, I guess you'd say the other way around, not just in this case, but in this world. Your final thoughts hearing Harvey Levin talking about putting up the funding for a documentary?
Well, you know, I truly believe in terms of from a law enforcement point of view, we are only going to experience more cases like this, where social media is used, where mainstream media is used, where kidnappers want Bitcoin, want cryptocurrency. We are in a complete point in this social media world that we live in with slews and everything else that it's totally changed, I think, for law enforcement. But when you look at this particular case, the rudimentary style, the incongruency of what Porch Guy did and combine that with the notes and how nothing is really fitting. This is just such a difficult case, not because it's maybe not that sophisticated, but it is so incongruent and it's something no one has ever seen, at least that I know. That's what I do all the time when I can't sleep at night is I try to find cases that are close to this. And I found some sort of close, some crypto cases. It's so hard, Joel. I think the case will be solved. It's just going to take a little bit more time. There's just too many roads that are available. There's the DNA, of course, there's the video, there's these notes. There's also the Bitcoin address. There are all these roads. They're going to go down and they're going to find it. I don't understand two things, Joel, real quick. One, why in the world isn't Porch Guy's face on all these signs, notices, billboards, and why isn't everything in Spanish as well? And then the other thing that I would suggest is raise it up to 2 million.
Yeah, let's see what that does. And Jen's been talking about that, having these billboards. It has not happened. I'm guessing the wind chimes are coming from Coffendoffer. I have to rule out Jason Pack because he's in a car. Howard Bloom does not strike me as a wind chime guy, but I don't know. Howard Bloom, by the way, it is Break the Case with Jen Coffendoffer on YouTube. Howard Bloom, he's been writing a book called Stranded, having nothing to do with this, about space and Ron Howard's making the movie. This is a real journalist here, not a fake one like me. Howard Bloom, when it comes to this story, are you staying on it? Where does your reporting go from here? Your final thoughts?
Well, at this point, I'm sort of interested in the journalistic aspects of the case so much, which I go back in time. I'm old enough, as you said before, you pointed out kindly, to go back to the Son of Sam case when I was a cub reporter at the New York Times. You know, Son of Sam was writing to Jimmy Breslin and the notes. And then the New York Post Breslin was at the Daily News. The New York Post invented letters to one of their reporters to try to keep up with this. Maybe we'll see someone else inventing that they're getting letters to keep up with TMZ. This is really a story about journalists. And there's the interesting dynamics of NBC's covering the case. I find that fascinating, how they're sympathetic to Savannah, and yet they're sort of exploiting her at the same time, bringing her out there, making her go through all this publicly. And she wants to do it because she's a journalist. She also wants to get attention for her mother. And yet one part of her wants to just hide too. So there's things to be analyzed here that I hope perhaps to look into in the weeks ahead.
That's actually a fascinating angle. The whole, I have to mute you here, Howard, but the whole notion of the media battling each other in this story in odd ways is fascinating. Jen Confidoffer, I need your advice on one last thing. So I'm invited tomorrow, Brazil, Scotland. If you're in Miami right now, you will see thousands of men who are in skirts, otherwise known as kilts. My son is a diehard Brazil fan, Neymar and Vinny Jr. He wants us to paint our faces and dye our hair, which I'm going to do. Am I going to get my ass kicked by a bunch of drunk Scots tomorrow? And if I do, what do I do, Jen Coffendoff?
Okay, pull their kilt up. No, in all seriousness, I don't think that you're going to have any trouble with them. I tell you, the Scottish people are so fun-loving and so great. I think they're going to be great seeing you and your kids dressed alike. But if it really comes down to it, I tell you, if you do that, they'll just run.
All right, I'm pull the kilt up. I heard they wear nothing underneath that. On that note, who knew we would get to kilts? It's always something on Surviving Survivor. Love you, Tennessee. Love you, Florida. Love you, New York. And, of course, Tucson, Arizona. Let's bring Nancy back home. Guess stick around one split second so I can thank you. And we might see you tomorrow at noon. We'll be back Thursday night, if not.